is Aaron Kohler, and it's an honor to be here as an alumnus of Rebel. I got my doctorate there a couple of years ago, which gives me unique standing among the speakers here this morning. The topic that we'll be tackling this morning is how the story of Yosef was read and interpreted and re-experienced among Jews living, especially under the Persian Empire, during the time of Bayit Sheni, in the time of the Second Temple. The Jews in the Persian Empire had some major theological issues to grapple with. For centuries, of course, the Jews had been not really politically autonomous for many years, since the time of the Assyrians, back in the 8th century. The Jews had really never been a world-class power, not a regional power, and were always subject to being beaten up and exiled if they crossed the line, if they crossed the wrong king. So certainly the experience of exile was not a new experience, and they could look back to Chumash, and they could look back to the Tochacha, where they could find promises of exile, threats of exile. In fact, one could claim that the threats of exile in Chumash were far worse than were actually experienced, because in Chumash, exile comes with essentially an abandonment of the religion of Israel. It meant that you would now go to exile and be obeyed Elohim Achirim. And the Jews, as they actually experienced exile, didn't do that. They retained their identity. But the Jews in the Persian Empire were in a worse theological situation than the Jews who had been exiled by the Babylonians, than the Jews who had lived under the Assyrians centuries earlier, because the Persian Empire was incredibly stable. The Persian Empire was not founded on annual military campaigns meant to consolidate the empire, meant to expand territory. Of course, the Persians fought a lot. You can see movies about their fighting. There's a lot of fighting in the Persian Empire, but the Persian Empire's specialty was actually peace. What the Persians were remarkable at was bureaucracy. They had an incredibly organized, systematized empire, which, as Esther tells us, stretched basically from India, to Sudan, south of Egypt, an immense swath of space. And the picture that you get from Esther is a remarkably realistic one. The mail system, the bureaucracy, messages could go from Sudan to India. I mean, messages today can't go from Sudan to India easily. Then they could go to the roads, the mails, the king's horses. These are the things that the Persians excelled at. Still on our post office, well, sorry, across the river, our post office in New York City, the post office, the central post office across the Madison Square Garden has an inscription from Herodotus celebrating the Persian mail system. Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night shall stay these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed round. That's about the Persian bureaucracy. That's about the Persian system of communication that that had been instituted not under the Babylonians, not under the Assyrians, but specifically under the Persians. Now, the Babylonian Empire, which of course had defeated Israel, had exiled Israel, Yehudah, lasted, depending on how you count, 50 years for the Jews, under 50 years. All together, beginning to end, maybe 70 years, really not a tremendous amount of time. So there was no one by the end of the Babylonian Empire who couldn't say that their parents, their grandparents, had lived before the Babylonian Empire. This was not a reality that just seemed to go on forever. The Babylonian Empire came, it conquered, and then it crumbled, just disappeared. But the Persian Empire took over for the Babylonians and just stayed. It established itself. It has remarkable endurance. In fact, if we can look back at it, it lasted for more than two centuries, controlling essentially the entire known world, not the Mediterranean part, but from Egypt all the way out to Asia. And the only reason it ever ended is because a guy named Alexander the Great beat it. But he was a remarkable individual. This does not speak to any weakness in the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire was an immensely powerful empire, not in the military sense like the Assyrians had been, not in a terrifying sense, but on the contrary, because it seemed so stable, because it seemed so everyday. This is just the way the world worked. Now, theologically, a huge challenge. Because it's one thing to deal with a king who's come in and beaten up the Israelites. Say, okay, so that's God. He's punishing us. He abandoned us for a reason. It's our fault. Eventually, we'll regain power. But this just seems to go on forever. Here, there's no end in sight. Nothing seems to be changing. We just seem to live in an alternate reality where all these stories that we know, we look back at Tanakh, we read Sefer Shmuel, we read Sefer Malachim, we read Shmot, and we look back and we say, you know, God and special relationship and the land of Israel, it's not true anymore. What happened? Our world seems to just be fundamentally different. Things seem to have totally changed. So the Jews seem to have looked back and looked for, well, where can we find precedent? Where can we find anything in the Torah that can give us an indication of how to grapple with this kind of reality? And the one obvious case that they settled on was the story of Yosef. Of course, there are others as well, but the one obvious one is the story of Yosef. And here, Jews were able to say, here's a Jew, born to a noble family in Israel, of course, the only family in Israel, but noble family in Israel, who lived in exile, who rose to prominence in a foreign court, in a foreign culture, and in doing so, was able to use his position to save his brethren, the Israelites. So maybe this is exactly the model that we need to adopt. And certainly some people were telling stories modeled on Yosef. So if you take, for example, story of Daniel. Of course, there are a whole bunch of stories of Daniel and his friends in the first half of Sefer Daniel. But Daniel, Perek Bet, is one that has many of the most remarkable similarities to the story of Yosef. I apologize, you don't have it in front of you in my handout. Maybe you have it in front of you anyway, but it's not there. But the story of Daniel, Perek Bet, is the story of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. He wakes up, and either he doesn't remember his dream, or he refuses to share his dream. What he asks of his Chartumim and Ashafim and Kasim, all of his magicians, is that they first tell him what he dreamed, and then interpret it. And he's very clear about why he demands this. They say, well, no, that's not the way it works. You tell us the dream, and then we interpret it. And he says, what am I, an idiot? If I tell you the dream, you can say anything you want. But if you tell me the dream, then I can actually check whether you're credible. If you can get the dream right, then I'll listen to you as to what it means. This is a good test. This is actually a remarkably cynical king. It's hard to say whether this was actually an attitude shared by many of the kings. We have hundreds and hundreds of texts of dream interpretation, omen interpretation, where kings do send to their prophets, to their necromancers, to their omen readers, dream interpreters, asking for the future. It's hard to say whether the kings were actually as cynical as Nebuchadnezzar here is portrayed. But certainly here, he asks for not just the interpretation, but the dream itself. The phraseology is drawn straight out of the story of Yosef. So we're told, Batitpa'im rucho, and he calls in the Chartumim, Batitpa'im ruchi. So that's a phrase, again, that we hear about Paro as well. In Bereshit, Batitpa'im rucho, his spirit was disturbed. He calls in Yosef, he calls in Daniel, and Daniel is able to not only interpret the dream, but first he has to share the dream. He correctly divines what the dream is. There's a long story as to how Daniel gets to the king, which we'll look at in detail in a couple of minutes. Daniel is not one of the people that the king turns to first. He turns to his whole class of dream interpreters, of magicians, and that might remind us again of Yosef, who of course was not someone that Paro had turned to. In fact, Yosef was nowhere to be found. Yosef was in jail. He's introduced, you recall, who introduces him? Hasar HaMashkim, who says there's a Hebrew lad, right, an Ivri, who's in jail with me, and he's really talented. Aryoch, the Babylonian who introduces Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar, comes to the king and says, speaking Aramaic, but he says, Hashkacha gvar min b'nei galuta Yehuda di pishral mokal Yehuda. I have found a man among the exiles of Yehud, who can tell the meaning of the king of the dream to the king. So again, introduced by one of the members of the court, and introduced with similar to introduced with similarly derogatory terms. So there's a Na'ar, a free Eved. There is a man from the Judean exile. He can share the meaning. Of course, he does come in. He's brought into to the king, and he's able to tell the king what the dream was, and then to interpret. Similar to the situation with Paro, here too the dream was a symbolic dream, which involved the future. Not all dreams, of course, are symbolic. Some have direct communication. Some have pictures. Some have words. These are symbolic, moving images, and both in Paro's dream and in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, Yosef and Daniel explain that it relates to the future. This is something really important for you as the king to know. God wants you to know the future. Now, what's the power of this kind of story? This is a story set in the court of the Babylonian king, set in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. Almost certainly, but not so important for us, written down in its current form under the Persians. And I was looking back at this already legendary hero, Daniel, who lived, let's say, a century ago under the Babylonian king, and telling stories about Daniel's exploits in the Babylonian court. Clearly the idea is to say, you know, that's how we're going to live as well. Yosef, our great hero from a millennium ago, survived, thrived, and was able to help the Jews by playing along with Paro, by helping Paro, by Egyptianizing. Daniel as well, because he was trained as a Babylonian, because he knew how to interpret Babylonian dreams, he rises to success in the Babylonian court. His promotion at the end is to be a Babylonian official. That's his reward. His reward is to say, okay, you are now a Babylonian nobleman, chief of the dream interpreters, chief magician in the Babylonian court. And of course, hopefully, he can now use this position to help the rest of the Jews. Now, the story of Daniel, and there are elements in most of the stories of Daniel, in the first six prakim of Daniel, that relate to in different ways the story of Yosef. But this story in particular is really interesting, because it doesn't just say that Daniel is another Yosef. It actually says that Daniel is better than Yosef. How is he better than Yosef? Well, first of all, in the simple matter of his powers. What did Yosef do? What was his great power? What did he actually do to impress Paro? What did he do? He interpreted the dream. What did Daniel do?
That's right.
Daniel is much better than Yosef. Daniel doesn't just interpret the dream. Nebuchadnezzar says, look, anyone can interpret dreams. Yosef can interpret dreams. That's not so impressive. But Daniel can actually tell the dream and then interpret it.
Power does a similar thing. Basically, they just wrote down a Rashi.
Very nice.
If you look at the comparison between the two, there's certain things that Yosef describes that power doesn't.
Very nice. Very nice. So some of it might be in the Torah, you say the last part, some of it might be some indications in the text itself, but absolutely, the Midrash certainly reads the Yosef story then back in light of the Daniel story, 100%. That's a remarkable circle that we get here. And as Daniel is reading Yosef, and then Chazal are reading Yosef in light of Daniel. It's really a fascinating dynamic. But just in terms of his powers as a dream interpreter, Daniel is presented as better, superior to Yosef. But I think more interestingly, Daniel is presented as superior to Yosef in terms of his Jewish identity. Because let's look back at Yosef. Let's think about Yosef again. If you're a Jew living under the Persian Empire, or under the Babylonian Empire, it doesn't matter that much. You look back to Yosef, and someone says to you, Yosef's our role model. You say, Yosef? Well, let's think about Yosef exactly. Yosef's our role model. Okay, so this is Yosef. He had a strong connection to God. He invokes God often. That's certainly true. He has a strong sense of morality. That's certainly true. He retains his Hebrew identity to a point. That's certainly true. And then he gets tossed into jail, where everyone knows that he's an Ivri still. Right? As you said, the Sar HaMashkim identifies him as an Ivri. So clearly this is an open identity that he's wearing. But then he gets called out of jail. What happens when he gets called out of jail? So we're actually told a couple of things. One is that he shaves. That's not a small thing. We know from all the Egyptian pictures, the Egyptians, certainly Egyptian priests, were clean-shaven. Canaanites, Israelites, always had beards. Not long, big beards. That was reserved for Assyrians, but shorter beards, shorter, bushy beards. That stereotype of the Canaanites and of Israelites is to have these short, bushy beards. Yosef shaves. He's now Egyptianized. Not just that, of course. That's superficial. Much more penetrating is that he then goes and marries a daughter of an Egyptian priest. He's given an Egyptian name. He speaks Egyptian at least well enough to trick the visiting Israelites into thinking that he's a native Egyptian. I don't know how well you have to speak Egyptian to do that, but at least there's a translator there. That's his language. He names his sons incredible names. First, thank you, God, for making me forget my past. And thank you, God, for making me flourish here in my new environment. So has he retained his Hebrew identity? Well, look, he's still talking to God. That's a good thing. But overtly, even covertly, he seems to be thoroughly Egyptianized. Is this the kind of role model that we want for us, our Jews, in exile in Persia? So certainly one can imagine someone saying, that's really a little bit beyond what we're looking for. I mean, we like the idea of succeeding in the foreign court. We like the idea of playing the games of the foreign kings, and thus succeeding, and thus rising to power, and thus rising to influence, and thus being able to help the Jews. That seems like a good idea. But to have someone actually turn their back and say, thank you, God, for making me forget my past, well, that seems a little bit extreme. Of course, you know, it raises all kinds of interesting questions about Yosef's own plans, which are kind of outside of our topic for this morning. But we have, of course, no indication that Yosef ever intended to do anything with his family again, had his brothers not actually shown up in front of him. So, of course, once they do, he concocts a whole plan to get his youngest brother there, and eventually, of course, to reconcile with the whole family. But had that not happened, had he not been presented with his family, every indication is that he was very happy to live as an Egyptian forever, severing all ties between himself and the Canaanite branch of his family, with whom he's no longer in communication. And so certainly someone I can understand, a Jewish community in the Persian Empire and the Babylonian Empire, saying, look, Yosef is kind of our one beacon of inspiration here, but we can't quite emulate Yosef. I mean, Yosef really took it a bit too far for our, not just for our taste, but for our chances of survival. I mean, if we all acculturate to the degree that Yosef did, then what's left? So Perek Bet makes Daniel a better dream interpreter, but it also does remarkable things to Daniel's piety. Before Daniel actually goes to the king, All right, that's true. Perek Aleph, he refuses to. No, it's absolutely true. And it's part of the bigger matrix here. He refuses to eat the food from the Babylonian court. Without any particular indication that there was a halakhic problem. It doesn't say it was meat that was trefa, just the food. The fact that it was the food of the Babylonian court. He says, I won't be sustained by the Babylonians. So there's a lot of resistance here, as opposed to Yosef, who, as far as we know, eats whatever they give him. Or when he's in charge, eats whatever everyone else is eating. But even in Perek Bet, before Daniel actually goes to the king, Yosef had said, Biladai, right? Not me. God interprets. God wants you to know things. But Daniel actually offers a long tefillah. Not only does he say to other people, it's not me, he actually turns to God and asks, Rav Yishmei de Elaham v'rachman olma v'ad olma d'chokhmata g'vurta d'ilehi. Let the name of God be blessed forever. God who's to whom wisdom and might belong. Praise God, whom Hashnei Danayav Zimnayam Haadei Malchin Makhei Malchin Yahev Chachmatal Chakimin Umanda Al Yadid Bina. He's the one who gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who know things. He reveals secrets. He knows what's in the dark. Light dwells with him. He thanks God. He praises God for helping him do all the very impressive feats that he's about to do, which are going to gain him stature. And this is far more overtly pious than Yosef ever shows himself to be. Again, Yosef says it's from God, but we never see him praying. We never see him engaging in any ritual activity. Daniel, not just here, but throughout, refuses to compromise one iota on his, not just religious beliefs, but his religious practices. To the extent that when a few prakim later, one of the kings is tricked into conned into making a decree that no one is allowed to pray to any god but to the king himself, Daniel goes to his home and at the window prays facing Yerushalayim as he always did. And of course gets tossed into the lion's den for doing that. And we can ask, do you have to pray at the window? Can't you just take four steps back so no one can see you from the street? But Daniel's answer is absolutely not. There's no compromises allowed here. My identity is paramount. My Jewish identity is paramount. In fact, the claim of all these stories seems to be that if you're first and foremost loyal as a Jew, then you'll turn out to be rewarded in the foreign system. So at the end of every single parak, the king realizes that God's really in charge, and the king makes a decree that you should worship God, or one shouldn't be persecuted for worshiping God, and Daniel or his friends Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah get rewarded in foreign terms. And as they get rewarded not by being granted a share in Olam Haba, they get rewarded by being promoted to governor of a province. They get rewarded by being promoted to chief magician of the empire. So the claim of Daniel seems to be, look, we have to emulate Yosef to some extent, but we have to be more stronger in our identity, in our outward identity as Jews. And the claim is that if you do that, God will help you, and you'll be rewarded in your current context. That's really, it's obviously a tough claim to swallow, but it's a remarkable claim.
Is it fair to compare before and after
Matan Torah to your practices? So I certainly don't mean to condemn Yosef. What I mean to ask is, when the Jews in Bayit Sheni times are looking back for role models, they would have been ambivalent about just saying, well, Yosef's our role model. Because they would say, look, Yosef is a tzaddik, no problem, absolutely. He's well enshrined in his place in Olam Haba, but we can't emulate him entirely, maybe because times have changed, maybe the empire is different, maybe Matan Torah has intervened. For whatever reason, we have to be actually not just like Yosef, but better than Yosef. So absolutely, I certainly don't mean to judge Yosef. At least one other story engages the story of Yosef as well. And that's the story of Esther. And what's interesting is that the author of Esther very clearly alludes to the story of Yosef at a number of points, but without any attempt at correction. So first of all, let's establish that in fact there's a connection between the story of Esther and the story of Yosef, although I think this is probably well known. But here you do have on the handout a number of the verbal parallels between the story of Esther and the story of Yosef. Now, I'm not going to try to claim that there's any particular significance to where these psukim show up in each story. I just want to use them to claim that there is a clear allusion to the Yosef story within the story of Esther. So you get simple ones. Like in the Yosef story, Paro had said, Ve'erkevo tovim rekevet ha-mishneh asher lo, ve'ekru lefanav avrech. He had him ride in the second chariot he had, and they called in front of him Avrech, whatever Avrech means. In Esther, Vayikach Hamanat al Bush Bet Asus Vayalbesh Et Mordechai Vayarkivehu Berchov Ha'ir Vayikra Lefanav Kacha Yaseli Shar Melech Hafetz Bikaro. So having him ride around and calling in front of him. Maybe even more striking. Vayasar Paro Et Tabato Me'al Yado Vayitain Ota Al Yad Yosef Vayalbesh Oto. Paro takes the ring from his own hand and gives it to Yosef, and then he clothes him. The king takes his ring, of course which he had taken from Haman, and gives it to Mordechai. The Vayalbesh Oto is in the previous one, in Perek Vav, Vayalbesh and Mordechai. Vayihi kidabra el Yosef yom yom velo shama ileha. Eshet Potifar speaks to Yosef every day, and he didn't listen to her. Many of these were actually, even more than this, were noted by the Midrash. Esther Rabbah actually has a long list of about 8 or 9 parallels between the Megillat Esther and the story of Yosef. Obviously, Midrash, as is its practice, doesn't exactly say what it wants by pointing out these these parallels, but a whole list. And Esther Rabbah is a complicated text, and it itself seems to consist of two parts. This is in the earlier part of Esther Rabbah. From the days of the Amoraim, they already had compiled lists of the parallels between Megillat Esther and the story of Yosef. And then, maybe one is less textually striking. Now, of course, besides the verbal similarities, which I think, and there, again, there are more, I think at this point they kind of drop off in the quality. These, I think, are the strongest, but there are more, and certainly once you have four or five that are strong, then I think we can even lower the bar and say, okay, so you know what, if you have three or four more that are not as striking, but they're relatively striking, then since we've already established that there clearly is a conscious decision on the part of the author of Esther to allude to the story of Yosef, then you could probably add the other ones listed in the Midrash as well and admit that those are probably intentional as well. But of course the whole story has a lot in common, even if the words had nothing in common. So the fact that a Jew rises to prominence in a foreign court, that's obviously true in the story of Yosef, it's true in the story of Daniel, it's true in the story of Esther. Now, if I asked you, when I said a Jew rises to prominence in a foreign court, which Jew would I be talking about in the story of Esther? You say Mordechai. There's another obvious
Esther.
Or Esther. And that's actually a really interesting question within Esther itself. Just to ask, who is the hero of the story? Who is the protagonist? And it's not an easy question to resolve. Of course, we call it Megillat Esther. The first time the holiday is ever referred to is in the Book of 2 Maccabees, which maybe we'll come back to in a few minutes. But the Book of 2 Maccabees actually refers to the celebration of the Mordechaian Day on 14th of Adar. So at least for that community, one could claim that they seem to have seen the hero not as Esther, but as Mordechai. As a literary question, I think it's a really excellent question. It's not easy to figure out who is the central character of this narrative. Esther is clearly the one who undergoes the most dynamic character. We see the most of her kind of introspection changing. Mordechai seems to be more stable, although not entirely stable. But by the end of the book, Esther fades to the background, and Mordechai seems to take over. So it's a really interesting question as to who is the protagonist of the story. And I think to some extent one could claim that we have to see them together as the protagonists, co-protagonists in the story. But when we say a Jew rises to prominence in the foreign court, I think it's fair to have both in mind. They both clearly do rise to prominence in the foreign court. And both of them obviously play central roles in the story. Some of these I think are more important than others. The most important thing to observe, I think really what makes this a powerful story, what made it a powerful story for the Jews in the Persian Empire, was the central claim that in order for the Jews to have been saved, the Jews needed to have someone on the inside. That's true in the Yosef story, and it's true in the Esther story. The basic problem that you have, that the political problem that the story of Esther seems to be exploring, is this Persian Empire is immensely powerful, immensely efficient, and at the core of it, entirely without direction. You get to the actual king, you say, well, what's the king like? You say, the king's like nothing. The king is just, is vacuous. I mean, you can whisper anything in his ear and he'll do it. But what's terrifying about that is that he's not an evil person. But what's terrifying about that is that he'll do whatever is whispered in his ear, and at the snap of his fingers, he can do anything from India to Sudan. So if the wrong guy whispers in his ear, if Haman, for absolutely no reason at all, I mean, what was the provocation here? One guy didn't bow down to him. So what? So okay. So it's beneath his honor to execute Mordechai, so he decides to whisper in the king's ear, we should kill all Jews in the entire known world. And you know what happens? It's done. That's it. The Persian Empire goes into action, the messengers go out, the bureaucracy is in the field, they're moving, and there's a real chance that just 11 months from now, all Jews in the entire world are going to be massacred. This is insane. I mean, this is the terror of the Persian Empire. It's not an evil empire, but you have to be able to manipulate it. You have to be able to navigate it. Because otherwise, who knows, there might be a Haman. He might get to the center of power. He might wander into the king's room, and then he might actually succeed in killing all the Jews. So how do we deal with this? What do we do? How do we survive in the Persian Empire?
Is this not a parallel to Yosef, who is gracious, everything goes good, and then once you get to Shmos, the exact same thing, and especially according to Rav and Shmuel, if it's the same king, then you have a situation that, for whatever reason, you have the same king at one point doing all kinds of wonderful things.
Next analogy is reversed.
Right. So is this one of the parallels between
That's interesting. It's very interesting. I think, come back to that one second, but I think it is really interesting. I think, obviously, the Rav and Shmuel things that, Pshat is Yaakov Melech Chadash, that he is an actual new king. But it could be another example of the Midrash, or at least one of the views of the Amoraim, reading again, and it's Esther's reading Yosef, but then the Amoraim are reading Yosef in light of Esther. And say, like, the kings are fickle. Who knows what the kings are going to do tomorrow? But it also raises a really interesting question about Esther, which is, what's the future hold according to Esther? And this works well as long as Mordechai and Esther are here. But they're going to die, and then what? What happens when Yaakov Melech Chadash? Oh, right. Well, okay, we're coming. Yeah. The Persian Empire, again, is not scary because it's evil. Esther's not claiming the Persian Empire is evil. It's scary because it's so immensely powerful and has absolutely no moral compass. So what's the solution to that? How do you deal with that? How do you live as a Jew? How do you make sure that the Jews are going to survive and even maybe thrive in the Persian Empire? So Esther says there's only one way. If they're going to have, there might be potentially a Haman, who's the Mishnelemela, who's up there, we have to have someone even closer. He's going to be in the halls of power. We have to have someone in the king's bedroom. And that's a remarkable claim. Because what has Esther done? Esther has, what's her Jewish identity like?
Non-existent.
Non-existent, absolutely. I mean, listen, she would not tell anyone that she was Jewish. Right? Daniel, like you said, refuses to eat the food of the palace. Right? Big deal, and he won't eat the food. What does Esther eat? Apparently whatever's given to her. She's not making a big deal. She can't make a big deal. She's bound to not say anything about her identity. So Esther seems to be a much closer parallel to Yosef than Daniel. Whereas Daniel is kind of an improved version of Yosef, Esther is actually another version of Yosef. Here's someone who has totally given up at least her outward Jewish identity. Of course, she had a Jewish name. No one's heard that since she was first introduced. Right? It's never used again the entire time. Daniel, interesting homework assignment, read through the first six prakim and see when he's called Daniel and when he's called Belshazzar. He officially has a Babylonian name, but that's the one that shows up really infrequently. Esther, her name Hadassah, never shows up. Once, at the very, very end, in Perek Tet, she's called, very strikingly, Esther bat Avichail, one last time. We heard her father at the beginning, we heard her father at the very end, as if to say, it wasn't all gone. She didn't turn from Hadassah bat Avichail to Esther Eshet Achashverosh. She actually turned into Esther bat Avichail. She was Queen Esther, but retained, or at least regained, the bat Avichail aspect of her identity. But for years, she was 5 years she was married before the Purim story actually unfolds. 5 years, we don't hear a single word out of her. We don't know whether she talks to Mordechai. We have no idea whether she has any outward, any practice, any prayer, any belief. We just have no idea. In fact, I think that the only really tense moment in the Megillah, the only tense moment in the story, is not at the end. By the time we get to the banquet, and even by the time we get to Esther coming into the throne room, we know, not only because we read it last year, but we know that things are going to go well. We know because we've been set up for that by the story of Haman and Mordechai, Balayla hu nadadash natamel. By that overnight episode, or early morning episode, we know that things are going really well. In fact, if we missed that, Zeresh told us. Zeresh, at the end of that parak, before the banquet, Zeresh said, if he's Jewish, you're going to fall. So we're set up. We know that there's actually no tension at that point anymore. Although kind of on the surface, Esther would have felt incredibly tense at the banquet. She's about to finally lay it all on the table. But we as readers have kind of been primed to know that things are going to go well for the Jews. There is, though, one point of a real tension in the story. And that's back in Perek Daled. That's when Mordechai comes to Esther and says, you have to do something. And tension is really, does Esther care anymore? I mean, Esther has a real conflict here between the man who brought her up when she was orphaned, her community of her childhood, but which she hasn't had anything to do with in half a dozen years or so. She probably left when she was about 15. Not only is she not engaged with this community anymore, but she's a loyal Persian citizen, and of course, not just a regular loyal Persian citizen, but married to the king. So where do her loyalties lie? Do they lie with Mordechai? Do they lie with Ahasuerus? That's a serious point of tension. And when she finally says, I'll do something, there I think is where the tension starts to go, kind of gets diffused in the story. But it's really about her identity. Her identity, the questions of her identity were set up to know that just like Yosef, she had shed all outward and maybe even inward signs of her Jewish identity. And at Perek Dalet, she asserts that there still is something there. She still does feel a connection. And as someone who feels a connection to the Jewish community, she's able to now use her remarkable position in Persian society for the good of the Jews. So that's a remarkable political claim. If this is what Esther is saying, this is how the Jews can survive in the Persian Empire. And remember, when Esther went to be the queen, there was no indication that this is ever going to work out for the good. Later, Mordechai says, "Mi yodea im la'id kazot higat l'malchut." Maybe this is what it was all about. 4 years ago, if you had asked me, 3 years ago, if you had asked me, 2 years ago, last year, if you had asked me, yesterday, if you had asked me, I would have had no idea why you had given up your Jewish identity. I knew it was the right thing to do, or I knew you didn't have a choice. But now I see maybe there's actually some reason for it. Of course, the most striking parallel between Esther and Yosef is probably the most famous fact about the story of Esther, and that's that God's not there. That's, you know, we learned that in elementary school, but it's the most important thing about the story of Esther. There's no God in the story. That's an amazing thing to do as a storyteller, as an author. It's not a question of whether God was actually acting. In most stories, the question is, are the characters invoking God? Are they talking about God? Are they referring to God? If you think about a story like Ruth, for example, God doesn't do anything, but he's mentioned a dozen times. Everyone's talking about God. God did this, God is good, God is wonderful, you're blessed to God. God's all over the place, even though God doesn't act in the story. So you can talk about God a lot without actually making God a character in the story. The author of Esther won't mention God, even in cases where there's no other way to understand what's going on. What does Zeresh mean when she says, well, if he's a Jew, you're going to fall? Why should I fall to a Jew? It's not true that you can't beat the Jews. The Jews are in exile. What do you mean you can't beat the Jews? You can beat the Jews, but sometimes, magically, you can't. Why not? I mean, there's only one way of understanding that. It has to have something to do with God. But the author won't say anything about God. Mordechai says to Esther, if you don't do anything, something. From where? What do you mean, Makom Acher? Who else? There's no one else. That's the whole point. You're the only one who can do this for us. No, we Makom Acher. Again, this is nonsense unless you invoke God. It just doesn't mean anything. But the author won't mention God. God is explicitly excised from the story. Now, if we go back to Bereishit, the major character in Bereishit is God, obviously. When he starts it all off, and he is the central character running through the entire story of Bereishit until Perek Lamed Zayin, until the story of Michirat Yosef. The whole Perek Lamed Zayin, there's no God in the story. Not mentioned at all. Now this is, a story that demands God. I'll tell you how we know it demands God. Yaakov sends Yosef to find his brothers in point A. They're not in point A. It turns out they went to point B. Point B just happens to be the place where caravans cross from the Arabian desert going to Egypt. At point A, there just happens to be a guy standing at the intersection saying, I know where your brothers are, they went to point B. This is an amazing series of coincidences. So amazing. How do we know that the story calls out for God? You have to read God into the story. Because Rashi says, who is the Ish? It was the Malach. This is so obviously God that you got to put God in the story. And yet, God's not in the story. It would have been the easiest thing in the world to say, God sent an angel, God gave Yosef a dream, God did anything in the world. but not a hint of God. Now, of course, in Bereishit, there's a resolution to that, because half a dozen times, Yosef says, it wasn't you, it was God. And it was later on in the story, even if in Paraglam and Zion, we're left wondering, saying, was that just a kind of strange coincidence, or was that really God? Yosef disambiguates for us. Yosef says, no, it was not you, it was God. What about the author of Esther? Leaves us hanging at the end. Is that because he's saying to us, look, I have so many parallels to the Yosef story that I expect you to make the same connection, to draw the same conclusion. I expect you to figure out that just like in the Yosef story, it was not you, it was God. I expect you to figure out that here too, it was not us, it was God. Or is it because after all of those connections, all of those allusions, the author wants to say, I don't have anyone to get up like Yosef. You could have had Mordechai stand up at the end and say, blessed be God who has orchestrated this whole thing. It wouldn't be that hard to do. Chances are Mordechai did that. It's hard to imagine that Mordechai actually went through this thing and didn't have some praise of God come out of his mouth at any point. But the author won't share it with us. The author leaves us wondering. But what happened here? An amazing, amazing story without God in it. Now, this is obviously, a really powerful story that the author is telling, really exploring some of the kind of basic questions of what it meant to be Jewish in the Persian Empire, these dual loyalties, when one sheds one loyalty for the other. But what kind of nails down the point that this was not a simple matter, that this was really a contentious issue, is that Esther was, I don't want to say quickly, but at some point, revised, it was edited, it was improved on. You have, in the rest of the handout, are some excerpts from what's usually called the Greek Esther. It's Greek in the sense that we have it in Greek. In other words, we have it in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of Tanakh, which means that if you open up your Catholic Bible, this is not an addition to Esther. This is actually the way Esther is told. I only copied the pages with the additions, but you have here actually a very different version of the story of Esther. There are six big additions to the story. They really change the story fundamentally. There are also a whole bunch of little changes, but the story is really fundamentally changed by the six big additions. So you have on the first page,
half the Bible doesn't use the Masoretic translation.
The Catholic Bible comes from the Septuagint. Martin Luther took out everything that was not in the Hebrew Bible. So if you want to get this in a non-Catholic Bible, look for the Apocrypha. Everything that was taken out of the Catholic Bible, which used to be the Christian Bible, but taken out of the Christian Bible because it wasn't in the Hebrew Bible, is now the Apocrypha. So you can get, if you open a copy of the Apocrypha, you get the Greek edition to Esther, or the edition to Esther.
Who wrote this text that we have?
Okay, so... So first, let's see a couple of the details here, and then we'll see where it comes from. So again, what we have here is another version of the story of Esther, a later, edited, revised version of Esther. And it starts very differently. You look for the Vayihi b'Melech Achashverosh, and it's there, but it's on the second page. First, it starts, once there was a Jew named Mordechai, who lived in the city of Shushan and served as a high official in the court of the Persian king. And the first parak is a dream that he had, where two huge dragons prepare to fight each other, the whole world is going to be destroyed, and then there's a tiny spring which turns into a mighty river, which brings light, sunrise, the meek are exalted and consume the mighty of the earth. And then we get the story of Big Time of Teresh, and then we get Vayihi b'Imei Achashverosh, Shu Achashverosh, and so on. If we turn to the last page, we have to navigate this. The last page, page 49. The top of the page you see has Perek Yud. The king then levied a tax upon his kingdom, both land and sea, and so on. And then you have the line that we were waiting for in Esther. All this has come from God, said Mordechai. For I now remember my dream, which foretold all of this. Not a single detail was lacking. Mordechai getting up and doing what Yosef did. Now this dream it's not just the overt religiosity here. It's not just the fact that we actually have now Mordechai who gets up and says, God told me about this before it happened. That's critically important. This is a very different story if you actually have Mordechai get up and say that at the end. But the dream itself is important. Because if one were to criticize Yosef and say, you know what, Yosef might not have had the right to shed his Jewish identity. Who gave him that right? One might say, well, after all, he had dreams. God gave him messages beforehand, something about him being king, something about this being preordained. It wasn't totally a surprise. It wasn't his own initiative. That's in defense of Yosef. Mordechai and Esther, what gave them the right to do it? They had no dreams. In this version, it's not true. Mordechai had a dream. Mordechai had the message from God beforehand. Mordechai is now even more similar to Yosef. So he's been legitimized as much as Yosef. If Yosef is legitimized by his dream beforehand, Mordechai can now be also said to be legitimized by his dream beforehand. And then, of course, it's really remarkably striking that Mordechai at the end gets up and says, this is from God, just like Yosef did. So God orchestrated this whole thing. He realizes it just as Yosef realized it. You ask where the text comes from. So the very bottom of that page, you have in the fourth year of the reign of Ptolemy and Cleopatra. Of course, you have to figure out three Ptolemies who are married to people named Cleopatra. But this, I think, supposedly Ptolemy, 13 to 78 BCE. First century, so this is the time of the Hashmonaim, deep in the Hashmonaim era. Dositheus, who said that he was a priest and Levite, and Ptolemy, his son, brought to Egypt the foregoing letter of Purim, which according to them was genuine, having been translated by Lysimachus, son of Ptolemy, a resident of Jerusalem. So where does this text come from? This text comes from Jerusalem, from Yerushalayim, sent to Egypt, presumably to Alexandria, to the Jewish community in Egypt, in Greek, of course. The text claims that this was translated by Lysimachus, not that it was written by Lysimachus. And modern scholars believe, on tenuous grounds, but reasonably, that most of these editions were actually not written originally in Greek, but were originally in Hebrew. And what we have here is not really the Hebrew Esther as opposed to the Greek Esther, but the original Hebrew Esther, and then a second revised edition of Hebrew Esther, which was translated into Greek and preserved only in Greek. The first correction that the reviser made to Esther was to add the dream and to add the revelation at the end that in fact this was all God. Let's turn back now to page...
The one that we have is the first? Or
yeah, the one that we have is the first. Yeah. I mean, it's a good question and it, you know, really requires a bigger discussion. Figure out how we know which one is the first, but a regular pot, yeah, we have the original one.
And who wrote this text itself?
Oh, that's just the editor's introduction. Sorry.
Which text does this come from?
This one is by Will, Timothy Will.
Okay.
Timothy? Something Will. I don't know. Okay. On page, very quickly, sorry. On bottom of page 39, we have a section from the third long edition to the text of Esther that we have in this version. What we have here is before Esther goes to the king, we actually get quoted two long tefillot, one by Mordechai and one by Esther. And we'll look very quickly at an excerpt from Esther's tefillah. Of course, the very existence of the tefillah is itself an amazing point. I mean, this changes the story dramatically. Far from being, you know, kind of hidden in her Jewishness forever, we never know whether she's really appealing to God or not. Here we have overtly, both Mordechai and Esther turn openly to God in prayer and davening, very traditional praise and bakasha from God. But the bottom of page 39 is some of the most striking lines. Remember me, O Lord. Let me know you are with us in the hour of our affliction. Grant me courage, O King of the gods and ruler of every dominion. Let my speech be eloquent before the lion. Let the heart of the king seethe with hatred for this man who is at war with us, so that he and all who have joined forces with him may perish. Deliver us by your hand, and help me who am alone, and have no one except you, O Lord. You know all things. You know that I despise the veneration I receive from the lawless, and loathe the bed of the uncircumcised, or of any foreigner. You know that I am forced to act as I do, and that I despise the symbol of my high estate, which I wear on my head when I appear in public. I despise it like a menstruous thread. In other words, the crown, which we thought was a symbol of honor. He says, no, it's a menstruous thread. It's disgusting. I do not wear it when I'm alone in my quarters. Your servant has also refused to eat at the table of Haman. So bringing her closer to Daniel in that sense, the resistance against the food. I'm not sure why Haman in particular. Neither have I attended the king's banquet, nor drunk the wine of his libations. So Yayin Nesech, or even Stam Yinam, was never a problem. The halachic issues she's managed to avoid. Again, something that we were led to believe was not true in the Hebrew text. The author of this edition has made sure to tell us, no, Esther was absolutely a halachic Jew as much as possible. And even the things that were symbols of the foreign empire, she despised. She went through with them, but she hated them. Your servant has had no happiness from the day of her selection as queen until now, except you, O Lord, God of Abraham. O God who conquers all, hear the plea of those in despair. Deliver us from the clutches of those who would do us evil, and deliver me also from my fear. We're not going to read the rest of the Tfilot, but I just want to sum up very quickly the dynamic that I think we see going through all of these stories. And that's that the Jews in exile, we're looking back to Yosef as the obvious model. Here's what we have. Here's what we have as precedent. We can't look to Yoshua. We can't look to David HaMelech. Who are we going to look to as our heroes? Yosef's the obvious role model. But for some of the Jews, that was a good role model. The author of Esther takes a really radical stand in claiming that this is an acceptable role model. It's okay, sometimes, in some circumstances, for some people at least, to actually shed all outward sides of Jewish identity, because that's how we might be in a good position to actually help the Jews. The author of Esther might have said to, let's say, Nehemiah, who lives in Shushan, and who asked the king, please relocate me to Yerushalayim so I can build walls. The author of Esther would have said, do you know what happens if we all go to Yerushalayim and we leave Shushan in the hands of Haman? You know what's going to happen in Yerushalayim? We're all going to get massacred. The Ramban, at the beginning of Masechta Megillah, actually points this out. The Ramban says Yerushalayim was in mortal danger, bigger danger than anywhere else, because he knows from stories in Ezra and Nehemiah that Yerushalayim was an unwalled city at this point, has no walls. So this is the danger. The author of Esther says, well, if we all get up out of Shushan and go to Yerushalayim, we will all get killed. The only way to make sure that we not only survive physically, but actually are able to live as Jews, is to, at least some of us, not just stay in Shushan, but actually be in the highest possible positions of power in Shushan. Just like Yosef. Isn't that the model that we have at our disposal? Isn't that what Yosef did? Mishneh Lamech, that's how we have to do it. And other Jews in the Persian Empire said, in principle, this is a good way of thinking, but you can't go so extreme. You can't really go like Yosef. Maybe times are different, maybe my times are rough, maybe because of Yosef's dreams, maybe all kinds of different reasons, but we can't really emulate Yosef. Yosef really went farther than we can go. Maybe not too far for him, but farther than we can go. We can't do that. So we have to be more pious than the stories tell about Yosef. And if you're going to have a story of Esther, we have to fix that up a little bit. So who sends the story? The Kohanim in Yerushalayim officially authorized the second revised version of Esther. Right? This is the Chashmonaim. What would the Chashmonaim have thought of Esther? Thought of her. The Persians come to you and say, either you come, you participate in this contest, or we kill you. What do the Chashmonaim say? So you die. I mean, that's just the way things are. Sometimes you have to die for your faith. Esther says, well, if we all die, you know what's going to happen? Then there are no more Jews. The Chashmonaim say, look, Esther, we can't get rid of Esther. I mean, Esther's a great story. It's an inspiring story. Everyone loves the story. But we got to tinker with it a little bit. We can't let it stay the way it is. We have to explain to people that the real authorized version of Esther has Esther davening, has Mordechai having dreams, and at the end of course, has Mordechai stepping back and saying to us, saying to the audience, saying to all his contemporaries, you have to see God in the story. So the polemics about the use of Yosef, I think, are alive and well throughout the centuries. I mean, this brings us down to the time of Chashmonaim, almost to the end of Bayit Sheni times, and that also brings us to the end of our time this morning. So I apologize for leaving so little time now. I'm not running out, but I do want to officially end so that Professor Alman can get started relatively on time. Thank you all for your attention.